One of the first things that Republicans in Congress have talked about doing is voting on the extension of the Keystone Pipeline project. This is something the president has threatened to veto. Are you simultaneously trying to find common ground with the president, or is this just going to be he stakes out ground that he knows you can't accept and you keep sending him bills that you know he'll veto?
Well, we're doing our job, Dennis. It's a great question. In the last 10 days, we passed more amendments than we did in all of 2014 in the United States Senate. These are on the Keystone Pipeline. So we are working hard to find bipartisan support. We've got that bipartisan support, and we hope that the president, regardless of his earlier comments, will see that bipartisan support in the Senate. This is a jobs bill, after all, and will go with us on it. But if he doesn't, we're doing our job. We're getting the Senate back to functioning the way the founders had in mind.
On the jobs claim, there was a study by Cornell University that questioned the statistics for the numbers of jobs that would be created. 119,000 was one estimate. And it questioned the methodology of that jobs claim and said, really, it won't, in the end, be a major source of long-term U.S. jobs. Wanted to get your response to that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I saw that study. What they were really talking about is these are construction-type jobs and so forth. But I would argue the different issue on jobs. I mean, these are jobs related to the construction of the pipeline. My position on the pipeline, when I say it's a jobs bill, is what it's going to do to the larger economy. The jobs I'm talking about are the long-term permanent jobs that come from having a domestic source, a North American source of oil, so we no longer have to be dependent on the vagaries of sources of oil from parts of the world that are very, very volatile.
But couldn't even more jobs be created, and the Cornell study indicated that, by putting our efforts into alternative or clean energy and its infrastructure?
Absolutely. I don't disagree with any of that. That takes time. This oil is ready to go right now. We need a bridge. I mean, nobody argues with the president that long-term we need to use all of the above sources of energy. This is about our economy and competing today with people in the rest of the world, and we're losing that edge, frankly, and that's what I'm concerned about. Long-term, I don't think anybody disagrees that we need to continue our research and development, continue to develop all these sources of energy, and that'll keep our economy competitive for our kids and grandkids.
One of the amendments that was voted on yesterday was one that dealt with climate change and whether or not human activity is responsible for that. How do you feel about that?
Well, this amendment was a great example of our, you know, bipartisan efforts here on both sides, frankly, that we got language in this bill that basically said that we all in the Senate agree that the climate change is real. We want to be responsible. Let me take the utility industry as an example. The alternative energy technology is not yet ready to be a baseload source. And so because of that, we just can't overnight make the conversion. So this is an attempt right now by the Senate to show that we're in agreement that climate change is real.
But is human activity at least partly responsible for it?
Well, I think that's the debate. And, you know, science, from what I can see, is not in total agreement on that. I know that one of the co-founders of Greenpeace is actually writing now about, you know, his views on this and aren't quite what they were a few years ago. So I think that's where the debate is. But, again, the Senate is right now trying to do its job relative to getting people back to work and getting the Senate functioning again, getting the economy functioning again. We're going to begin to move on to some of these other bills that were stuck on Harry Reid's desk at the end of last year to get our country moving again.
Let me turn to the fair tax for a moment. That's one of the bills that you have co-sponsored since you've been there. It's a little complicated to explain, but it's a consumption tax. It is one of several consumption tax proposals out there. How realistic is it to submit that measure when, first of all, it would likely face a presidential veto, and secondly, there are even some economists on the business side who question whether it would actually work in practice?
Well, first of all, it's a grassroots idea. I mean, it has a lot of background in Georgia. It's not the only alternative, as you say. But let me put it in context. We know that the current IRS system is not functioning. This is a grassroots attempt to start a debate, Dennis. This is not, I don't expect this bill to pass in the next 2 weeks. This is a replacement, by the way, for the IRS and for the income tax structure that we have right now.
Proponents of the fair tax have tried to account for its possible regressive effect on really low-income people by working out ways where there could be rebates or a number of things to shield them from that. But wouldn't it still shift a great deal of the tax burden, if not to the very poor, then certainly to the middle class?
Well, no. I think there are studies that do show that if you didn't have the prebate, that it would be potentially regressive on lower-income people relative to the necessities of life. And that's why there are various programs in there that that take care of that and address that. But again, the real attempt here is to give people control, take the control away from the federal government, and let individuals determine how much they're going to pay based on their consumption. And so it really is an attempt to drastically change how we collect money to fund U.S. government. Let's talk about a bigger issue as well. It's not only how we fund it, but what do we do with it when we get it? I mean, there's some $480 billion of redundant agencies up here. I'm on the budget committee. We're beginning to put together the budget for 2015, and it's a difficult process given the rules, but we are beginning to argue our point that we've got to cut spending, get the economy going to solve this debt crisis.
And what you're talking about there is a comprehensive approach, kind of tax reform and spending reform. Isn't that exactly what the Gang of Six, including your predecessor, Saxby Chambliss, worked on for a long time on both sides of the aisle? Their proposals never got anywhere in the previous Congress, but why not start with that?
Well, in many respects, we are. You're right. We've had various attempts, and it just, that illustrates the fact that we really do have a crisis. This $18 trillion of debt is unmanageable. If interest rates were at the 30-year historical average of 6%, we would already be paying over $1 trillion in interest. But beyond that, our future unfunded liabilities related to Social Security, Medicare, pension and benefits for federal employees, and just the interest on the debt as it grows over the next few decades is well over $100 trillion. And so we've got to begin facing up to the realities that we cannot keep spending the way we're spending without directly addressing these long-term financial issues that are creating the crisis right now.
But does that mean also reforming taxes and, for instance, on the revenue side, saying, look, the Bush tax cuts, which were put in some years ago, may have to be revisited?
Well, right now, we've proven over and over, even in my lifetime, that increasing taxes puts a drag on the economy. What we've got to do is grow the economy. We've had gridlock up here between the debate this, and it's a great question. If you watch the debates up here, a lot of gridlock comes from the bilateral argument about tax increases versus spending cuts. You're not going to solve this financial crisis unless we get our economy going. And that's why we're already talking about how to reform our tax code. And by the way, that doesn't just affect revenue. What it does is it helps get the economy going by creating a level playing field.
One of the ways the president talked about getting the economy going was by raising the federal minimum wage. And he asked the question, if you think you could live on $15,000 a year, why not try it? What would be your response to that?
Well, you know, he's talking about a minimum wage increase that, you know, it was never intended that many people live on that minimum wage anyway. It was always intended to be an entry-level protection, and that's exactly what it is. When I first began working, one of my first jobs was in a peach packing shed. And, you know, we worked for a minimum wage then, but it allowed us to get into the workforce. I think the statistic is somewhere around 2% of our workforce is at that. But here's what I take issue with the president. You know, he says, well, if we increase the minimum wage, that will create jobs. That has been proven to not be true over time. And right now, what we need to do is get good quality, and I'm going to underline this, full-time jobs. The administration brags about all the jobs being created, but many of those, frankly, most of those are part-time jobs. This 30-hour work week that is included in Obamacare is really holding the economy back. And in addition, small businesses are really having a difficult time creating jobs because of Obamacare. Two-thirds of our small businesses have either stopped hiring or have pulled back employment. I get stopped on the street so many times by people saying, hey, help me get my hours up. This 30-hour work week is really devastating the middle class right now.
But even before Obamacare, weren't a lot of companies simply hiring part-time people instead of full-time people? In other words, whatever factor the Affordable Care Act might play in this, isn't there a lot more to this than just that? Is it fair to say, oh, okay, it's just because of Obamacare, or have companies cut back on the kinds of jobs that both you and the president are talking about?
Well, as a past CEO, I can tell you that it didn't make a lot of sense to just cut hours back. I mean, what you did is you adjusted the workforce for the work required. If you weren't growing, yeah, it was a problem. And so that's why we have to become more competitive. I don't think Obamacare is the only cause of the part-time issue, but it is by far the largest contributor right now. And we saw a spike in that just a couple of years ago when it became law. And I've seen that as a small business person myself.
Will the Senate Republicans go for a full repeal of Obamacare, since we have seen an improvement in the sign-up process, more people signing up, a lot of folks who didn't have insurance before who now have it, despite some of the problems on the other side where people have said, including yourself, that some people have lost their coverage? Aren't we at a place where there may be modifications, but for the moment, the ACA is a reality, and it's time for negotiating rather than saying all or nothing?
Well, I think as long as we have our current president, it's going to be very difficult to totally get him to not veto any repeal. What we're going to do is probably have one more vote as an amendment somewhere where we will vote to repeal it. And I think Congressman Tom Price, from right there in Georgia, he's the budget
House Budget Committee Chair.
House Budget Chairman, and he and I are working together right now. I mean, you're going to hear a lot more debate in the coming months about his alternative to the Affordable Care Act.
Real quickly, you have proposed a bill on term limits. Explain what that is, and as a freshman, isn't there the risk that with mandatory term limits, something you just have to, where somebody would just have to leave, that you could lose institutional memory in an institution that might actually need it?
Well, when I looked at this, there were some statistics that sort of led me to my opinion, Dennis. First of all, there are about 36 U.S. senators who have been in elected office of one form or another for over 30 years. We have created a political class in this country, and I look at the results of Washington, and I tie the two together. The drive to get reelected affects decision-making, and I just don't think that's what the founders had in mind. I just don't think the founders ever imagined the potential for the rise of a career politician. They saw a citizen legislator as the person to be involved, to come to Washington to try to make a difference in the problem of the day and then go home. This bill would simply put the limit at two terms for a U.S. senator and three terms for a U.S. A representative. And what that would do would be to pull more people into the system. I'm an outsider to the system. I've never run for anything in my life until I ran for the U.S. Senate. People say, you can't do that. Well, you've jumped the line or something like that. Well, I think more people need to do that. We need fresh opinions, fresh perspectives up here. Yes, institutional knowledge is important, but getting locked into these bipartisan arguments that just lead to gridlock is not what we need today. And frankly, I think this is beginning to get a grassroots support around the country. I know in Georgia this is a very, very popular grassroots desire is to see term limits employed up here.
And very quickly, though, especially when you're talking about three terms for a House member, that's just 6 years. It often takes members of the House or any member of Congress several years at least just to get a hang of how things work.
Well, that's a great point. And I think, there's room for negotiation here. I think 12 to 18 years, which is this current bill would allow someone 18 years up here if they started in the House and went to the Senate, which a lot of people do. The intent is, again, to create the opportunity for more people to be involved in the system. I mean, the money is unconscionable. The time it takes to run a campaign is too long. The process is our process. There's room for negotiation. We put it on the table to start a bipartisan debate on it. This is going to get a lot of attention over the next couple of years.
But wouldn't the money be in the campaigns no matter who's running? I mean, the idea of folks with political action committees and special interests is simply to fund people who agree with them, whether they're brand new or whether they've been there 30 years.
Yeah, I didn't mean to intimate that the two go together. I mean, I think they're two separate issues. Campaign finance reform has been tried. The Supreme Court has spoken on that. The idea right now is on the separate side of trying to limit the years of participation up here. Look, this is not everybody agrees with this, obviously, or it ought to be law, but I'm just one person that is representing a theme from the state of Georgia that it's very important that this get debated in Washington. And so I'm trying to do my part to represent and fight for what I know the people in Georgia want. And this one is one that was a very popular theme as I went around the state in the last 2 years talking to people.
David Perdue is Georgia's new Republican senator. Senator, thanks so much for this time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis.